Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Amanda Burke, bar registration number 39311, and I'm here along with Gregory Giametti on behalf of Monica Vickery, the plaintiff appellant in this case. As the panel is aware, this appeal concerns the dismissal of Monica Vickery's complaint against appellees in its entirety, including claims for fraudulent transfer, fraudulent concealment, and conspiracy to defraud creditors. The appellees have characterized the issue on appeal simply as Monica Vickery's frustration at their prudent use of a legitimate estate planning device. This case is both factually and legally unique, but perhaps the most unique aspect of this case is that appellees admit that their conduct was fraudulent because their intent was to hinder Monica Vickery, who was their creditor, of both Evelyn Trumbull and Mary Gail Vickery.
Where is this admission contained, counsel? Where do we look for that?
Multiple times in the brief, Judge.
They're off microphone now. I hope you understand.
In both the briefs, the answer briefs of Mary Gail Vickery and Evelyn Trumbull, they admit that the purpose of Evelyn Trumbull's amendment of her trust was to prevent her assets from going to satisfy the judgment that was obtained by Monica Vickery. So it's a unique case in that the intent to hinder or delay the collection of a debt is not really at issue in this case. In dismissing the claims, the trial court substituted its judgment for that of the fact finder, basically viewing this case as if all of the evidence had been presented and the court didn't buy the allegations of the complaint. If this court affirms the dismissal of the claims in this case, the Court of Appeals will be endorsing admittedly fraudulent conduct.
Let me just clarify something you said. You said that the trial court considered all of the evidence, not just the allegations of the complaint, in deciding it, or was this decided under 12b-5?
The court cited 12b-5. The appellees have argued that it's a 12b-1 issue.
Yes.
I think that since the court specifically cited a 12b-5, that's the provision that we have to assume that the court relied on. My point was that the court basically was judging the veracity of the allegations and not accepting the allegations of the complaint as true.
Okay, thank you.
Which would be required under both 12b-1 and 12b-5.
Thank you very much.
So as was discussed in the briefs, appellant's fraudulent transfer claim relates to the amendment of the will, or the trust, rather, of Evelyn Trumbull, in which she had deposited her primary assets. There was a judgment entered in an underlying case for both compensatory and punitive damages in favor of Monica Vickery and against Evelyn Trumbull and Mary Gail Vickery. The jury found the conduct of these defendants to be so egregious that punitive damages were awarded on every single claim returned in Monica Vickery's favor. February 2009, the court held a hearing on the issue of costs and orally announced a joint judgment for costs against both Mary Gail Vickery and Evelyn Trumbull. And on that very day, Evelyn Trumbull amended her trust to bypass her daughter, Mary Gail Vickery, and instead leave all of her assets to her granddaughter, Carrie Vickery, who's an appellee in this case.
Let me, if I may, just to ask, what is the transfer that you are contending was fraudulent?
The transfer would be the amendment of the will, which bypassed Mary Gail Vickery.
What asset was transferred as a result of that?
Well, although no assets of Evelyn Trumbull's were necessarily transferred in terms of her interest in those assets did not change because she still retained access to those assets as the settlor and beneficiary of the trust. However, there is case law to establish that the Colorado Uniform Fraudulent Transfers Act, or actually the Uniform Act in general, does support a claim for a fraudulent transfer for assets of someone other than the debtor that are transferred. The case I would refer the court to is the Philip v. Bucarenshu case. It's a California Court of Appeals case cited in our reply brief. And in that case, the court set aside numerous transfers as fraudulent, including transfers made by the debtor's ex-wife of property in her own name. In that case, the court found that even though the creditor did not have a judgment against the ex-wife, transfers made by her of assets titled in her name alone were fraudulent and came within the scope of the statute.
As I understand it, in this case, Evelyn will say, did not transfer any assets of hers, right?
That's correct. But in the Philip case, judgment was entered against the ex-wife for transferring her own assets for the purpose of fraudulently
I understand that. But here, Evelyn didn't transfer her own assets. Isn't that different from the case you're citing where the ex-wife transferred her own assets?
I think that the Wright case that was cited in our brief is also instructive on this issue. It's an Arizona Court of Appeals case. And in that case, the court found that merely changing the character of an asset, even though the assets were not transferred, could constitute a transfer. In that case, it involved the amendment of a prenuptial agreement with regard to each spouse's future earnings. And the court found that because the character of those assets was changed, that constituted a transfer under the broad definition of transfer in the Uniform Fraudulent Transfers Act.
Counsel, do you have any authority for the concept that Mary Gale had an interest in the trust assets before they were transferred away?
Yes, Judge. In the complaint, appellant alleged that Mary Gale Vickery, both before and after the transfer, was enjoying the trust assets. In the underlying complaint, which was attached as an exhibit to the complaint in this case, there's an allegation regarding a general power of attorney that was granted. And it was actually quite broad. And of course, the trial court did not know the terms of that power of attorney because Monica Vickery was not allowed a chance to present any evidence in favor of her claims. But she had a power of attorney that was alleged in the complaint. And the functional change that the amended trust had was really only to shield those assets from Monica Vickery, because Mary Gale Vickery continued, it's alleged in the complaint, that she continued to enjoy and have access and possession of the trust assets.
But did you allege that her expectation interest of being able to inherit the trust assets, is there some allegation that you've made in the complaint that she had some sort of a right in that expectation that got transferred away to defraud creditors?
Well, yes. Yes.
Where is that in the complaint?
In the I think, Judge, without spending a lot of time flipping through my notes, I think, Judge, that is encompassed in the allegation that she was enjoying the trust assets and also that she was enjoying the trust assets and that she had been granted a power of attorney, which gave her various rights to dispose of and otherwise use the assets as if she was standing in her mother's shoes.
Lots of people have a power of attorney, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they have an expectation to inherit all the trust assets.
Well, she did. She had the trust, which was attached as Exhibit 1 to the complaint, left all trust assets to her. When it was amended, she was bypassed in favor of her daughter, and the allegation is that her daughter has been facilitating her continued and unfettered use of the trust assets.
But you're not disputing that Ms. Trumbull had the right to change the beneficiary of her trust, are you?
That she had executed the amended trust?
Right, but not only that she executed it, but that she had the right to change the beneficiary.
Oh, she had a right.
To whomever she wanted.
Well, certainly, absent fraud, she would have had a right to revoke her trust. That's an issue that was raised by appellees in their brief multiple times. But by analogy, a lot of fraudulent transfer claims are based on the sale of property for a nominal value. And in those cases, if it's shown that sale was made for the fraudulent for a fraudulent purpose, then the debtor can't come back and say, well, I had a right as a title holder to that property to make a sale. when a transfer is accompanied by fraud, just because it's otherwise legal in conventional circumstances, doesn't mean it does not fall within the scope of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfers Act. That issue is addressed in the Arizona v. Wright case as well, because the husband and wife argued that since they had a statutory right to amend their prenuptial agreement, that that transfer, as it were, could not be deemed a fraudulent transfer. And the court specifically rejected that argument, saying that many fraudulent conveyances might be legal under conventional circumstances, but despite the fact that a transfer may be otherwise legal, it's the purpose behind the transaction, not the transaction itself, that brings a transfer under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfers Act. So, I mean, in this case, sure, if Evelyn Trumbull could have amended her trust for a multitude of purposes, but fraud is not one of them. Even if Mary Gail Vickery had not been granted a general power of attorney for her mother, I think that factual issues preclude the determination that her expectancy interest, her contingent and unvested interest in the trust, did not constitute property. Unfortunately, there have not been a lot of Colorado cases that have addressed the definition of asset and property under the Act. However, the Colorado cases cited in our briefs interpreting the probate code are illustrative on this issue. Another case, in Ray Smith, it's a bankruptcy case. That case holds that that a beneficiary interest in a revocable trust that was contingent and unvested at the time the petition was filed did constitute property of the bankruptcy estate. The court in that case rejected very similar arguments made by appellees in this case, saying that the mere fact that the interest of a beneficiary is contingent and not vested does not preclude creditors of the beneficiary from reaching it.
In that case, though, before there was a discharge, weren't all the expectancy was realized, so those assets were in the possession and control of the
Sure.
Apart from, I understand you have alleged that she's somehow getting, she is enjoying the use of these assets, but apart from that, she's not, because Mary Gail has not attained actual title to the assets or their actual possession.
Right, but under the C.B. Richard Ellis case, the court held that the pertinent time frame in analyzing whether or not a transfer is fraudulent is the time that the transfer takes place. At that time, Evelyn Trumbull was still a debtor. Her intent was to prevent Monica Vickery from collecting her judgment. And similarly, the pertinent time frame in a bankruptcy case is the time the petition was filed. And at that time, it was still a contingent and unvested interest in the Smith case.
Other than, Evelyn was, I guess, still a debtor at the time she made the transfer. I understand that. Or she made the amendment to her trust. But all but $24,000 of the judgment were recovered. So with respect to a fraudulent transfer by her, isn't the liability capped at $24,000?
Well, against Evelyn, that might be true, but it just goes to show that the fraudulent transfer claim, she was still a debtor at that, or she would have been a debtor had it not been for the fraudulent concealment, which I'm running out of time to discuss that claim, but they're related. Monica Vickery has alleged that she would not have settled that claim for the amount that she did had she known that this amended trust had been executed.
Did anybody ever represented to her that that trust was still in effect at the time it was produced?
No.
Or had anybody ever represented that it hadn't been changed?
No, and it's a fraudulent concealment claim as opposed to a fraudulent misrepresentation claim. And I will say that the issue of whether or not she inquired or investigated, that's a factual issue, which we believe is supported by the evidence. And I'll reserve just my last 30 seconds.
Very good. Thanks.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Jessica Higgins-Catlin, bar registration number 32665. Appearing at council table with me is Renee Ezer. I represent defendant Mary Gail Vickery. Ms. Ezer represents the Evelyn V. Trumbull Living Trust, and with your permission, we will be splitting the time today. Your Honor, just to be clear, because there was a statement made by the appellee that the defendants have admitted fraud in this case, at no point, at no junction, and not in a single pleading, have any of the defendants admitted any fraud whatsoever. Beneficiaries of a revocable trust are treated as if they had no existing property interests, so long as the power to revoke exists. Accordingly, these revocable trusts are not reachable by the creditors of those beneficiaries. That is from the Restatement Third of Trust, Section 56, Comment B. We have no disagreement that Evelyn Trumbull always retained the right to revoke her living trust pursuant to the terms of that document up until the moment she died. Said another way, as this court previously held, an expectant heir cannot, on the basis of his expectancy, maintain an action during life of his ancestor to cancel a transfer by such ancestor, and he cannot maintain a suit for the enforcement or adjudication of a right in the property. That's Nelson versus Nelson, 31, Colorado Appeals, 63, 1972. If Mary Gail Vickery had no protected interest in the trust assets, neither do her creditors, including the plaintiff. Evelyn had the right to disinherit her child, even to the detriment of a child's creditors. Plaintiff's arguments fail under CRCP B5 because they fail to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. Plaintiff asserts in her fraudulent transfer claim that she tries to state that Mary Gail Vickery had a property interest in her expectancy. Your Honor, I think it was Judge Terry who questioned whether or not Colorado has addressed the definition of property. It has addressed the question of property in a different, slightly different context. Under the Uniform Colorado Dissolution of Marriage Act, which is at 1410.113, this court previously held under the Gorman case that an expectancy interest in a revocable trust was a property interest subject to division under the UDMA. The Colorado legislature went back under 1410.113, subsection 7, and specified very clearly that a donative third-party instrument, whether that be a revocable trust or a will that is subject to absolute revocation powers, a beneficiary has no interest, property or otherwise, in such an expectancy. In the Dale case,
That case is limited to the domestic dissolution of marriage context, right?
The case was decided under the UDMA, yes, mm-hmm. But specifically it defines what a revocable trust gives a beneficiary, where a revocable instrument, whether it be it a will or a trust, is always revocable by a settlor or a testator. So it is within the UDMA, but it specifically addresses trust assets and whether or not a beneficiary has an expectancy interest or otherwise. And previously under both the Balancing case and the Dale case, the Balancing is 107 P3rd 1037, specifies that an interest in a trust cannot be classified as property until that trust becomes irrevocable under subsection 7B.
Ms. Catlin, let me just ask you about your premise here that the Uniform Dissolution of Marriage Act cases and statute are applicable, given Supreme Court case law that says that the use of a particular term in one set of statutes does not necessarily carry over to a different area of the law.
Good question, Your Honor. I would say that generally that would be applicable. However, in this particular context, because the courts, both Balancing and this court in Dale, specifically looked at the issue of revocation on estate planning documents and whether there was a property interest associated with them, I think even if it weren't directly on point, it is analogous in this situation.
How do you respond to the bankruptcy cases that have been cited by your opposing counsel?
Good question, Your Honor. The bankruptcy cases are distinguishable. As Judge Miller said previously, the bankruptcy cases are distinguishable because at the time that, within a bankruptcy context, a debtor is given 180 days as a sort of look-back period before and after the bankruptcy is filed. At the time that the debtor in those cases was, the transfer was examined, the debtor had come into and the trust or revocable document had become irrevocable, either through a testator dying under a will or a revocable instrument becoming irrevocable at the death of the testator or trustor. So that the cases are very distinguishable because there was a vested interest at that point. In these cases, the interests are mere expectancies. That's a quantifiable difference between what Mary Gail Vickery had at the time that the plaintiff asserts that there was a transfer made and what happened in the bankruptcy context. Even assuming that there was an expectancy interest in trust property, there was no transfer as defined under QIFTA. And I'll repeat that. There was no transfer. The definition of transfer under QIFTA is, quote, every mode, direct or indirect, absolute or conditional, voluntary or involuntary, of disposing of or parting with an asset. 38.8.102 CRS. As the plaintiff conceded, or petitioner in this case, or appellant conceded, at the time of the amendment, Evelyn Trumbull never disposed of any assets. She had a full and unfettered right to use those assets, to transfer them, to give them to the Humane Society if she wished to do so prior to her death. There was no disposing as defined under QIFTA, which is a requirement as defined by the statute. Further, even if it's construed as a transfer, so that's even if the property is construed, the mere expectancy is construed as a property, and even if the transfer was considered a transfer, the final key, the linchpin here, is that Evelyn, when she made the transfer, if you're going to construe it as that, she never became insolvent. Under 38.8.105.1b, it requires that the transferor is left in a position as to be impecunious, meaning that the transfer, if the transferor has plenty of assets with which to satisfy her debts, there can be no transfer or no fraud under QIFTA.
Well, that's for the transferor to become insolvent, but what if you're preventing giving someone property, assuming that there was a right for Mary Gail to receive property, which, you know, we're talking about in theoretical terms at this point. What happens is Evelyn makes sure that she doesn't get this property, and for the purpose, express purpose of making sure that she can't pay off this debt. Now, why is that not covered by QIFTA?
The purpose of QIFTA is to protect a transferor avoiding her own debts. QIFTA was never put in place for a transferor to be responsible for the debts of third parties. That's what the trial court found, that while the provisions of QIFTA are very broad for creditors, quote, it is not so broad to include creditors of other individuals. By what the petitioner is asserting, or the plaintiff is asserting, every parent would somehow become absolutely obligated to ensure that their child received all of his or her assets to satisfy a creditor of a child. It would diminish and defeat hundreds of years of common law in probate, which says that a parent or any person has the right to give his or her property to whomever he or she chooses. And if that defeats a creditor of a third party, that's part of our law. The third party is not, or the initial creditor, Evelyn Trumbull, is not responsible for a debt for Mary Gail Vickery. Nor are any of us responsible for a debt for Mary Gail Vickery, irrespective of whether at one point in her life she would have had a child be receiving some of her assets. And before I go, I just wanted to point one other thing out. The plaintiff in this case indicated that because Mary Gail Vickery at one point had a power of attorney, that she was somehow obligated or allowed to use the assets for her own use. An agent is under fiduciary obligation. That's the highest legal standard from one person to another. The use of a principal's assets for your own benefit is a violation of every fiduciary law out there. So to assert that, well, she could have used it for her own benefit, therefore transmutes this POA into an absolute right to use it for her own benefit is against every fiduciary law that Colorado has previously adopted. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Renee Easer here on behalf of the Evelyn V. Trumbull Living Trust and its trustee, Carrie Vickery. I'm not sure where to start. I'd like to offer a couple of cases in response to a question to Ms. Catlin before I get on to 12B1. When Justice Terry asked about how she would respond to some of the bankruptcy cases offered by the plaintiff, with reference to characterizing Mary Gale's expectancy as property, I would direct the court to cases in Oregon and California that find that a beneficiary of a revocable trust does not have a property interest. And those cases are Schmidt versus Ulrich at 215 BR 417, and Heifetz, Heifetz v. Bank of America at 147, Cal App 2nd, 776, and its secondary site is 305 P2nd, 979.
This case is cited in your brief?
I don't believe they are, Your Honor. As I was preparing for this hearing, I looked at cases that weren't in my brief.
Well, there's a provision, as you probably know, for filing supplemental authorities, but go ahead.
With reference to the 12B1 argument that Monica Vickery lacks standing to bring this appeal and to bring her complaint, the opening brief failed to allege error, and in fact it completely ignored the trial court's unequivocal conclusion that even if it accepted all of the allegations in the complaint as true, Monica did not sustain an injury to a legally protected interest. The opening brief only requested review of the court's dismissal based upon 12B5. However, Monica unquestionably understood the dual basis for the court's May 17, 2010 ruling. The memorandum attached to her Rule 59 motion had a separate section for the law applicable to a motion to dismiss for lack of standing. And that section in Monica's brief stated that a plaintiff lacks standing if, taking all the allegations of the complaint are true, she demonstrates that she suffered an injury, in fact, to a legally protected interest. As a matter of procedure, Your Honors, the trial court determined that Monica lacked standing, and Monica failed to allege error in that determination to this court.
So in your view, the trial court ruled on both 12B1 and 12B5, is that correct?
Yes, somewhat inartfully.
And because Monica didn't address 12B1, you think on that basis that you win?
I think there's a final unappealable order from the trial court that says she did not sustain an injury to a legally protected interest, yes.
So, and as I said, because Monica didn't address that in her brief, then you believe that you're entitled to prevail on that basis?
Well, I think we're entitled to prevail on both the 12B5 and 12B1 issues. And so I'm not... All roads lead to Rome. It's a matter of...
Some of the roads are jurisdictional and others are not.
I think there's support for this court finding, affirming the trial court's ruling on both bases.
In any event, we can decide jurisdiction even if it wasn't considered by the trial court, right?
You could, and yet my understanding is when there's a final order that hasn't been appealed at the trial court, that an appellant's failure to challenge any one of the grounds for the court's ruling, this court is required to accept the non-appealed rule as the law of the case. And that is what happened here. And the failure to bring it up, it's not a mere technicality. There has to be, so even if you were to look beyond that, substantively, there is an injury to a legally protected interest. The Evelyn's assets were used to satisfy Evelyn's debt, and there shouldn't be confusion in this case because both Mary Gail and Evelyn were debtors. To the extent that there was a transfer, and I don't think that there was, it would have been Evelyn's transfer, and it would have been of Evelyn's assets, and Evelyn didn't, and Evelyn's debt was satisfied.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Burke, you have approximately 30 seconds, and I wanted to advise you that if you would like to respond to the two cases that were cited for the first time this afternoon, you can do so if you get a letter to us within 10 days.
I will do that, Judge. Thank you. Just a few quick things. Appellees cited to the restatement of trust third section 56, and I think that that's important, especially because that section goes on to state that where there's a power of appointment or power of attorney, the beneficiary interest in a trust is treated as actual ownership because that's what the power confers upon them. So I would encourage you to read the remaining portions of that section.
We'll do that. Thank you very much. And thank you both counsel, or all three counsel, for your arguments. The matter is submitted, and a decision will be forthcoming in due course.